Okay, I was also asked to announce, and this is more serious, that today's class is, has been dedicated in loving memory of Zev Tzvi Ben Zakaria on his yahrzeit, which is the 7th of Nisan. That's Zev Tzvi Ben Zakaria. Okay, this is going to be our last class before Pesach. No, I will not be giving class next week. By the way I see, things are starting to, run down anyhow. And I thought that what I would do is give you a little bit of a taste of my approach to the Haggadah today. Those of you who have purchased it, some of this will be, and have looked at it already, some of this will be review. But what I'd like to do is give you a sense of what it means to approach the Seder night in a global fashion, which has really been the push that I've felt for many, many years. And over the span of the years of the rabbinate, I found that our encounter with the Haggadah every year is somewhat problematic. And that's because we tend to see the Haggadah in sort of, just by reading, a disjointed fashion. We're not quite sure what its overall goals are, why one paragraph follows the next, why it seems to go off on tangents. And what I'd like to do is sort of pull back from that a little bit, and instead of focusing on little pieces, sort of take a look at the global flow of the Haggadah, and to recognize that part of the reason, there are two reasons, I think, that we see the Haggadah in disjointed fashion, and that is, number one, the Haggadah follows Talmudic logic. And what I mean by that is, if you've ever studied a page of Talmud, you'll know that the Talmud is conversation in suspended animation. A page of the Talmud is a snapshot of a conversation that's taking place over time. And like every conversation, it doesn't follow a clear structure sometimes, because what will happen is somebody will say, I feel this way, or I hold this position, and someone else will get up and say, well, that reminds me of something that so-and-so said over there. And you'll bop from one theme to the next and from one topic to the next. And the rabbis did that because they wanted to maintain the oral flavor of the Talmud. But it becomes hard to follow sometimes because of that process. And the Haggadah follows the same style in some cases, where it will move aside and then come back. It will digress to a particular series of events and come back. For example, one of the most important one of the most loved sections in the Haggadah is the Arba Bonim, the four sons, because it's so picturesque and has so much material to talk about. But what most people don't realize is that is part of a digression. That's not part of the main flow of the Haggadah. That's part of a digression that the Haggadah makes to sort of quantify the mitzvah and then to come back to the mitzvah. So it's important to sort of see what the flow is. Secondly, and this is, again, one of the reasons that we get sidetracked, is because every section is so beautiful, we sometimes focus on the particular and lose the forest for the trees. So what I'd like to do tonight is the following. Still feels like night to me. Number one, I'd like to first take a look at three layers to the Seder experience. There are three layers in which or through which the Seder unfolds. Then take a look at a particular recreation of a historical moment, and then take a look at one piece of the Haggadah and see how it fits in. So let's start with the first section. The first layer, I believe, to understanding the Haggadah is to recognize that it is a structure for the performance of six or seven discrete mitzvot. In other words, there are six or seven, and you'll see why I say six or seven, mitzvot that are unique to the Seder night. And what the rabbis do in creating the Seder, and the first Haggadah that we are aware of begins to emerge already in the 4th to 3rd century BCE, during the period of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, which is way back. And what the rabbis do is they take these mitzvot and they create a structure for their performance that is cohesive and whole. So that if, for example, you have the mitzvah of 4 cups of wine on the Seder night, instead of just sitting down and saying, okay, I'm going to do the mitzvah of the 4 cups and drinking them one right after the other, you find them woven into a structure. The other mitzvot are woven into that structure. So from one perspective, the Seder night, the Haggadah, is a structure for the performance of these mitzvot. And let's just review what they are and their origin and character. There are 2 biblical mitzvot that we perform on the Seder night. And when I say they're biblical, I mean biblical through and through, meaning they originate biblically and they are performed today as a biblical requirement. What would those 2 mitzvot be? Matzah is one. Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim, the telling of the story of the Exodus. Those are the 2 mitzvot that originate biblically. Matzah, it says, Erev Tochlu Matzot, you have to eat matzah on this night. Concerning the Sipur, it says 2 psukim are used to define the mitzvah, and that is V'igadeto levincho bayomahu lemor, that you will tell your children on this day, and also the mitzvah Laman Tizkor, so that you will remember the Exodus all the days of your life. Those 2 mitzvot create the mitzvah of Haggadah. 2 psukim create the mitzvah of Haggadah. So those are 2 biblical mitzvot, originate biblically, perform biblically today. Then there are 2 rabbinic mitzvot. And when I say rabbinic, again, I mean through and through. They originate rabbinically, and they're performed as a rabbinic obligation today. What would those 2 mitzvot be? Maror, no, because it originates biblically. We're going to come back to Maror, right? I'm saying the mitzvah that originates rabbinically and is performed rabbinically, and that would be Arba Kosot, the 4 cups of wine, and Hesebo, the mitzvah of leaning, which may or may not, you may count that as an independent mitzvah, or it's attached to certain parts of the Seder, and it may be a component in the performance of those mitzvot, but it is a rabbinic obligation. And these two rabbinic mitzvot actually originate from the same Mishnah in the Talmudic tractate of Pesachim, where the rabbis seem to make it clear that these 2 rabbinic mitzvot, the 4 cups of wine and the leaning, their primary purpose is to show and to feel freedom. That apparently they felt that even with the other mitzvot of the night, you wouldn't feel the sense of freedom enough, especially if you're not in the best condition. They talk about an ani, afili ani shebi Yisrael, even a poor person has to feel free this night, and that's why we're mandating these mitzvot. And here you can really see how the rabbis take the mitzvah and weave it in. For example, the 4 cups of wine, as I said, are woven into the fabric of the evening. They are signposts for the evening. The first cup is Kiddush. The second cup takes place after Magid. The third cup takes place after the meal. And the 4th cup is the conclusion of the Seder. Really, what comes after that is epilogue. So what you have is 4 cups of wine woven into the Seder as a signpost, but when you perform them, one of the things, the reasons I'm focusing on this is I think it's very worthwhile at the Seder, when you arrive at these mitzvot, to say, you know what, we're about to perform a discrete mitzvah at this point. We're about to perform a rabbinic mitzvah, and this is the 2nd cup of wine. This is the 3rd cup of wine. We're about to say Magid. This is a biblical mitzvah. And just show how the mitzvot are woven into the evening. Then we come to a transformed mitzvah. And that's Maror. Maror originates biblically, but today is a rabbinic mitzvah. All right? Why is that so? It's very interesting. The pasuk says, or a pasuk in the Torah says, Al matzos umrorim yochluhu. You're supposed to eat the Pesach sacrifice with matzah and maror. The Torah then commands matzah again independently. The Torah never commands maror. independently. So maror, biblically, is a requirement only when you have the Pesach sacrifice. Along come the rabbis, and they say, wait a minute. Fine, we don't have to eat maror, but we're going to make it a rabbinic mitzvah. And the rabbinic, and they place it into a unit of mitzvot that populate our year. And that is a mitzvah, zecher lemikdash. It is, you're eating maror, not as a fulfillment of the biblical obligation to eat maror, you're eating maror as a remembrance of the glory of the temple. Now that's different than zecher lechorban. There are two kinds of mitzvah to remember the temple. One is to remember the glory, it's a positive mitzvah, and one is to remember the chorban, that's to remember the destruction of the temple. We're remembering with maror, even though it seems a little incongruous because maror is bitter, but we're remembering the time when we ate maror with the Pesach sacrifice, which is why after we eat maror, what do we say? The very next paragraph, and what do? We make a sandwich, and what are the words we say? Zecher lemikdash kehillel. And we're saying, we're doing this as a remembrance of what Hillel did and how he fulfilled the maror mitzvah at that time. Then there is a mitzvah of debated origin. What I mean by that is, it's a machlokes, it's a difference of opinion as to whether this mitzvah is rabbinic in origin or biblical in origin. Anyone want to take a shot? Hallel. The recitation of Hallel on the Seder night is a mitzvah. And to make it more complicated, even those who say that Hallel year-round is rabbinic, many will say on the Seder night it's biblical, that it emerges as part of the obligation of Magid, that you just don't tell the story, but you show gratitude, you praise God. So Hallel is a rabbinic mitzvah, is a mitzvah of debated origin. And then the last one you're not going to get, because I didn't even know it myself before I prepared for the Haggadah. And that is, if there is a debate in the Mishnah as to whether charoset is a mitzvah. All right, whether eating of charoset is a rabbinic mitzvah, or is it just a tradition, or is it there for other reasons? And some will say that charoset is there for health, to counteract the maror. All right. So the question of whether the eating of charoset is a mitzvah is debated across time. The Rambam actually seems to have a contradiction between two sources where he calls it a mitzvah and one doesn't. If it is a mitzvah, it's rabbinic, obviously, but it's debated whether it's a mitzvah or not. So anyway, that's layer one. Layer one is to look at the Seder as a technical structure created by the rabbis to enable us to perform a series of mitzvot that are specific to the Seder night. Now, there are other mitzvot we do, but I'm not counting them because we do them year-round. Netilat yadayim, benching, etc., etc. Those are not counted. We're talking here about six or seven mitzvot that are specific to the night of the Seder. Then the second layer to understanding the Seder is that the Seder night is a recreation of one specific historical moment. Right, so what would that moment be? All right. So many people say Yitziat Mitzrayim. It's to recreate the Exodus. She said the night before the Seder, and she's right. You see, if we were going to recreate the Exodus, let's talk about this for a minute. When did we leave Mitzrayim? What time of the day? Actually, in the middle of the day. Middle of the day. Etzem hayom hazeh. And it's part of let's recreate in our minds the series of events. In the middle of the night, Paro comes to Moshe after Makas Bechorot and says, get the heck out of here. Go, finally, you're out, go. And Moshe says, oh, not so fast. Right? Now that you've decided we can go, we're going to go when we decide to go. And we're not going to sneak out as thieves in the night. We're not going to end our stay here, you know, in a lowly fashion. We're going to walk out in the middle of the day. Etzem hayom hazeh. We're going to walk out in full view of your entire population. We're going to march out in our army. That's how we're going to leave Mitzrayim. And as the beginning of a nation. Well, very good question. We'll get to that. All right, we'll get to that. Excellent, excellent. So the truth is we're waiting now. We're not going out so fast. And if we were going to celebrate Yetzias Mitzrayim, then we should have the Seder the first day in the afternoon. Or if you happen to be in America where the davening takes long, around the time of the rabbi's speech, you could get up and walk around, and that would be, which most people do anyway. But the fact is that we are not recreating that moment. We are recreating the night before Yetzias Mitzrayim. We are reimagining what it was like to sit around the table and have the Pesach sacrifice. Because that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to do. Sort of incongruously. He says, you're going to get out tomorrow, now sit down and have a family meal. Right? And that is, which is what the Pesach, Korban Pesach was at that point. It was totally a family and then unit meal. Now, why then are we recreating that moment? Why aren't we recreating Yetziat Mitzrayim? It would be logical to recreate when we actually leave. So I think there are a number of very powerful lessons learned from the fact that we're... Now, when I say we recreate this moment, we do so with some reluctance, especially in the Ashkenazic community. In the Ashkenazic community, we don't eat dry roast meat at the Seder. Why? Because we don't want to say we're recreating the Korban Pesach. We're making it. We're recreating the moment, but we want to make it sure that you don't think we're saying we're offering the Korban Pesach. The Sfardim actually go the opposite route. The Sfardim say we want to recreate the moment more clearly, and therefore they dafka have roast meat, dry roast meat at the Seder. Anyway, let's talk about what might be some of the lessons emerging from this night. The first is the distinction between liberty and freedom. Or in Hebrew, dror and chayrut. Yes? Sure. Because the matzah still is a mitzvah for us today. It's still a biblical mitzvah. The Korban Pesach, with the absence of the temple, is no longer a mitzvah for us. Right? The real question is, why did the rabbis take Maror, which isn't a mitzvah, and why didn't they do that with the Pesach? And I think that there they want to wait for the Pesach to come back when the Beis HaMikdash returns. All right, so here we are. So what's the distinction between dror and chayrut? The Torah talks about dror. Ukrasem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveha. You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It's a pasuk from Parshas Bahar. It talks about the freeing of the slaves and the Jubilee year. I was once, one of the years that I was teaching at Yeshiva University, I asked my students where that sentence is found in American history. Where is it inscribed? And the only one who knew was a Canadian. All right? It's inscribed on the Liberty Bell. Correct. Ukrasem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveha. Liberty is granted to you by someone else. Liberty is the removal of the negative constraints upon your development, upon your life. That's why that word is used for the freeing of the slaves. Chayrut, according to Jewish thought, is different. Chayrut is something you discover for yourself. It is something that comes from leading a meaningful life, from being free. The rabbis will say, Ein lecha ben chorin, elo mi she'osek batorah. The only one who is truly free is someone who is involved in Torah study and Torah learning, or Torah observance. So the question is, when do we become free? And the answer seems to be that we don't become free when we leave Egypt. We become free the night before. We become free when that night we take the God of Egypt and we turn to that outside world and we say, your God is no longer our God. We slaughter that animal, we eat it, we say we are beginning our national journey. And it's a powerful message that is being taught to us, that you can be free even if you're not at liberty, and you can be at liberty and not be free. Here we are not at liberty yet, but we're free. And how many times in Jewish history has that scene have to be replayed, where you're living in the darkness of the night, when you are constrained and you are proclaiming your freedom? I had the opportunity to visit before Glasnost, to visit prisoners of conscience in the Soviet Union, and clearly remember them saying to us, we are the only free people in the Soviet Union. And you'd look at them and say, wait, you lose your jobs, you're thrown into jail. What do you mean you're... They say, no, we're the only free people because we're the ones saying you can't control us. You can do whatever you want, but you can't control us. We are free. And that's what we're doing the night of the Seder. We're reliving that moment when we are still in the darkness of Egyptian slavery. Cairo has not yet said go. We're starting to eat before that. And we're saying, guess what? You can't touch us anymore. You can do whatever you want, but we're free. And I think that's one of the reasons we celebrate that night. The second is that it speaks to us of the foundations of our nationhood. Think for a moment what's happening here. We are about to be born as a nation. Tziat Mitzrayim is the first step in becoming a nation. Exodus, Har Sinai. So God announces, you're becoming a nation tomorrow, and what I want you to do is, I don't want you to have constitutional conventions. I don't want you to have town hall rallies, all the things that would normally go into building a nation or proclaiming freedom. I don't want you to have committee meetings, thank God, otherwise we'd still be in Egypt. All right? What I want you to do is, I want you to go home. And in the safety of your home, I want you, first, as a family, and if for some reason the family can't do it, then I want you to reach out to your neighbor, and I want you to make sure that you take enough for each person, because every person has to do his bit. And there you have the foundations of Jewish nationhood: the family, the community, and personal responsibility. And the family particularly is being underscored here, because God is saying, you began as a family, and you're still a family even after you become a people. And the most important unit in your survival will be what? Will be the family. Someone asks me what the greatest failing of American Jewry today is. It's not assimilation. Assimilation is the symptom. It's the abdication of the family unit of its responsibility to educate the children. In other words, in the reform and conservative movement, family doesn't observe necessarily. You send them to the Hebrew school. The Hebrew school teaches, but family doesn't. And even in the Orthodox community, if someone comes to me and says, I want the school to teach my child not to cheat. No. You teach your child not to cheat. The school should underscore that message. But if the child sees you cheating at the taxes, or hears you talking about it, or if the child sees you telling him or her to crawl under the turnstile when he's 13 because he can still pass his 12, then what you are doing is, you're teaching your child to cheat, right? And, well, look at the cheating scandals going on now, right? I mean, so the fact is that these are, we are underscoring the building blocks of nationhood with the Pesach sacrifice, particularly the family, but the community and personal responsibility as well. And then the final issue, and this is going to answer your question about Chipazon. Look at the last line that I quote concerning the Pesach sacrifice. Sentence 12, your base. And thus you shall eat it, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. The Pesach it is to Hashem. So it sounds like a recipe for indigestion, if you ask me, right? What do I want you to do? I'm telling you, you're leaving tomorrow. Get dressed, put on, take the staff, get pack your bags, sit there with your clothes on, and eat a meal. So you have, the Medrash says that Bnei Israel turned to Hashem and said, Hashem, forget the meal, let's just get out of here already. And Hashem says, no, this is what I want you to do. So we have to understand, number one, what's this chipazon? It's not just the matzah, this whole sense of haste that's being manufactured here when I know that I'm not getting out till tomorrow. Why is the Pesach sacrifice also symbolized haste? It was dry roasted, that was very fast, you ate it in haste. So there are a couple of answers to this. I think the most important, and then we'll have a second, is that Hashem is teaching us that critical moments in our experience are often presented in momentary fashion, in fleeting moments of time. In other words, if we think back on our lives, there are opportunities. If you don't take that opportunity, when it presents itself, when it comes, it's too late. And therefore, what Hashem is saying to us is that every moment of time is precious, and you have to grab it. And even though you're not going to get out tomorrow, I want you to feel like it could come at any moment. Because just remember, even though you've been waiting 300 years or 210 years for this moment to come, if you fall asleep tomorrow at 11 o'clock and you don't wake up till 1, you're stuck in Egypt. When it finally comes, it's presented in a moment. And that's why we deliberately hold back. And that matzah becomes a symbol of that. Think about matzah. It's an amazing symbol. What's the difference between matzah and chametz? How much time? A split second of time. Everybody says 18 minutes. 18 minutes is not right. 18 minutes is, if you take flour and water, and you mix it and leave it for 18 minutes, and let it go over that time, it becomes chametz. If you catch it at 17.9999 and you throw it into the oven, what do you got? You got matzah. And these two antithetical symbols are so different, you know, that we get rid of the chametz. They're totally alike. The halacha is that to be kosher for matzah, it must be something that could have been chametz. Right? That's the definition of kosher matzah. So what are we being told? It's a split second of time. And that's the same message emerging here from this scene is the message that emerges from matzah. And what's fascinating also, and you can talk about this at the Seder, is we refer to matzah twice at the Seder. The first time we refer to it, we call it lechem oni, which means the bread of affliction. The second, and it exists already before the moment of the Exodus. It's there at the Pesach sacrifice. Matzah comes into being even before that moment. The second time we refer to it, we say, ki b'chipazon yatzah samer tzitzrayim, that you didn't have time for it to rise because you left Mitzrayim in haste. So let me ask you a question. Is matzah a symbol of slavery or freedom? The answer is it's a symbol of both. It's a symbol of both. And the way I believe it symbolizes both, because how can you symbolize antithetical symbols? It particularly symbolizes the split second of transition from one to the other. That's how it brings both. So it's a symbol of slavery and freedom. But more importantly, it's the symbol of that moment being grabbed when you had the opportunity to become free. So that's lesson number one coming from this b'chipazon. The second lesson emerges from a statement of Rav Yossi Haglili. Yossi says, looking at this scene of sitting and eating this meal fully prepared for the journey. It's not on your sheet. I'm going to quote it. He says the following. Mikan derech eretz li'ovrei drachim sheyu mezurazim. He says, from here you learn good advice to travelers. Be prepared. So I look at this statement the first time I learn it, and I say, well, that's very nice. So Rabbi Yossi Aglieli is giving me good advice. I should pack my bags before I go. What's this statement? So it's another example of how the rabbis take powerful imagery and convey it in pithy sentences. What is Rabbi Yossi saying? Who are the travelers? B'nei Yisrael. When does the journey begin? Right now. You want to survive that journey? Be prepared today for tomorrow. Always keep in mind this scene of being prepared for Yetzias Mitzrayim the night before it happens. You will survive if you can hone, and this is a difficult talent to hone, some way of recognizing the seeds of change before the change occurs. And this concept, it's what we the rabbis call it? The rabbis call it Roeh es Hanolad, to see that which is about to be born. And we as Jews have had to somehow hone that talent, and it gets more and more difficult sometimes. It's like that famous story, which I don't know if it's true, of the eye doctor. I may have told this to you, I don't remember. The eye doctor in Germany, who in the 1930s turns around and sees the changes beginning to occur in his country, puts a sign outside his door and says, "Ladies and to all my patients, I am moving to Eretz Yisrael. If you are nearsighted, there's a doctor around the corner. If you're farsighted, follow me." All right? And it's easy for us to say, right, being the ones that aren't there at the time and how hard it must have been to make moves like that. But it is, and one of the things you could talk about at the Seder is how do we maintain this talent in a world where the changes are so unpredictable and so instantaneous. It's like we spoke about this on Purim, Vinahafohu, everything turns around in an instant. The people who are your friends or your enemies, the people who are your enemies or your friends. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next few days here in Eretz Israel, and who are going to be friends and who are going to be enemies, and I forget that I called you a traitor. It's okay, whatever. I didn't mean it. Who knows what's going to happen, right? So it's going to be, so how do we deal with that? How do we as Jews try to be aware enough? Do the Jews in America have to wake up? Do the Jews in Britain have to wake up? Do other Jews throughout the world have to wake up and say, guess what? Things are changing. Wow. It's a difficult way to live, and you've got to balance it with being comfortable where you are, but at the same time, not so comfortable that you can't turn around and say, as you're saying, 10 years from now, the America we've known may not be the America that will be there. And the same thing with all the other countries that we're living in. So this is certainly another reason. These are all reasons why I think we are marking the night before the Exodus as opposed to the moment of the Exodus itself. 18 minutes is, according to Chazal, the physical time it takes for wheat and water to ferment. In other words, it's based on a physical study. I never heard them. I'm sure they're beautiful, but on a very Litvak level, as I tell you, it is what. Now, be careful. Apparently, that 18 minutes is if nothing else, if you start kneading or if you start moving, then it's shorter. The 18 minutes is the top. All right. Finally, there is a third layer. All right, so let's go back. I want to keep us focused. We're talking about different layers to understanding the Seder. We spoke about layer number one being technical, the halachic fulfillment of certain mitzvot. The second layer is the recreation of the night of the Korban Pesach. The third layer, which I think is the most important and the most complex, is what I would call the experiential layer, which is what is the, in the final analysis, what is the ultimate goal of the Seder? What is it trying to do? And I think the way to see that is to ask ourselves an interesting question when we look at the night from a distance. When do we eat? That's the question that everybody asks, right? When do we eat? So where is the meal in the structure of the Seder night? It's in the middle of the Seder. It's in the middle of Hallel, right? Which is very interesting. In other words, we say a couple of paragraphs in Hallel, we stop and eat the meal, and then we finish Hallel. And the question is why? That's really very strange. You know, if you think outside the box and say, you know, if I were constructing the Seder night, maybe we should eat and then do all the ritual, which would be nice, but probably we wouldn't end up doing the ritual. Or maybe we should do all the ritual first and then eat. Why are we putting the meal smack dab in the middle? So I think the answer is take a look at the structure of the Seder. After you get past what I call unit one, which is a unit where you just do introductory events, Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, those are events that are specifically meant to cause questions to come. We're doing things to make the children, so that's an introduction, that's setting the stage. After that, the Seder can be divided into three units. Everything in the text before the meal talks about the past. Everything in the text after the meal talks about the future. So what's the meal? The present. And this correlates to a very beautiful thought of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik says that we as Jews are an eternal people because we practice three tasks of time awareness in every moment. He says, number one, the Jew lives through retrospection. We carry the past with us. I can't think of any other people that carries the past on its shoulders the way we do. We take it for granted, but it's an amazing thing. The past lives with us. We're always thinking about it. It's part of, and it helps shape who we are, and it helps shape our lives. It helps shape our sense of mission. The past. Anticipation. We are a people that carries the future with us. What do I mean by that? So using the Rav's thoughts, the Rav said that we introduced the concept of a destiny-driven history to the world. What does that mean? That we introduce the concept of Moshiach, we introduce the concept that history is going somewhere. It's not just being propelled by the past, but it's being pulled by the future. And until that point, history was just perceived as haphazard. It was a history of causality. One era causing what's going to happen to the next, etc., etc. Now, that's true, but we're going somewhere. So we live anticipation. And then the third time awareness task, which is the most difficult, is appreciation. Appreciation is to appreciate the historical context of the moment in which you live. To say, what's our particular challenge? How are we doing? Are we succeeding or are we failing? How will history judge us 200 years from now, the way we judge other eras? And what we do is we take the meal and we put it into the middle of the Seder and we say, this is a meal like no other in the year. History is surrounding us. History is laid out before us, what we've just done. History is laid out before us, what we're about to do. And what are we supposed to be thinking and talking about at the meal? How do we fit in? Where's what's our role? How will we uniquely, what's the unique place of world Jewry, Israeli Jewry? Where do we fit into all of this? And what begins to emerge when you see this as the structure of the Seder is that the ultimate goal of the Seder is not just to have us re-experience or relive a moment of history. It is to inject us into the historical process. Every individual at the Seder, if the Seder works, should walk away from that event feeling that on the moment, on the holiday that begins Jewish national history, I more clearly found myself as part of that history. The ultimate goal of the Seder is to see how much history means to us and how much we are meant to mean to history. What do we mean to history? And if that can be accomplished, then the Seder achieves its goal. Now, how does the Seder train us to do this? This is it's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to suddenly leave the world in which we're involved in all the politics and this, and then say, okay, let's back up, let's live history, let's see it objectively. It's very, very difficult. So turn the page to page 3. And here, I can't go into this in depth, but those of you who have my Haggadah will see it outlined with color and whatever, and I'll just review it. The mitzvah of Magid is structured to take an individual and thrust him into history. The rabbis basically, by the time you get to the Mishnah, which is 200 of the Common Era, the rabbis outline a 3-stage process for the unfolding of Magid. It ends up being confused with digressions that are put in between, but there's a clear 3-stage path. Path stage number 1, is maschil beginus umesayim b'shvach. That's what the rabbis say. You start with the negative. We're now about to tell the story of the Exodus. What do? You start with the negative and you go to the positive. Now, what does this consist of in the Seder? Manishtano and the 2 answers to the Manishtano. Avadim hayinu, that's a primary paragraph. We were once slaves. And a paragraph we recite a few pages later, Mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu, we began as idolaters. That's the second answer to the Manishtana. Those are the primary paragraphs of this first stage. Now, what is this first stage about? In fact, the rabbi's statement is kind of strange. They're selling me something I already know. Start with the negative and go to the positive. Yeah, sure. I'm going to do that. If I'm going to talk about the Exodus, we were once slaves and now we're free. The rabbis are saying, I believe, that the first stage to becoming part of the historical flow of the Jewish people is historical awareness. Be aware that Jewish history, Messiah, Maschil Beginus Messiah Mishvach, Jewish history is a path, not just the Exodus, that takes us from the negative to the positive. And that's why we not only say Avodim Hayinu, that's why we also answer the Manishtano with, we were once idolaters. We go back to the beginning of the story. Because we're saying, this is the first stage to see myself as part of this flow, is to recognize that there is a flow. Okay, is to recognize that we're moving in a positive, we're trying to move towards this great goal. Second stage. Second stage of Magid, according to the Mishnah, we do something very interesting. We take a paragraph of Torah text and we learn it together. The second stage of Magid is an exercise in Torah study. What do? We take the passage that begins with the words, it's a paragraph, Arami Oved Avi. My father was a wanderer, and we announce it. We say, Tsei Ulamat, let's go out and learn. This is now the beginning of the second stage of Magid. And we learn this paragraph, Arami Oved Avi, I was a wandering Aramean, or the way that Haggadah interprets it, Chazal interpret it, Aramean tried to destroy my father, Lavan tried to destroy my father, etc., etc., etc. Now, if what is this paragraph that we're studying? Where does it come from? Arami Oved Avi. Where does it come from? It comes from the book of Deuteronomy, from the book of Devarim. It is Vidui Bikurim. It is the formula recited by a farmer who brings his first fruits to the temple, the Bikurim, and he recites this formula when he brings the Bikurim. Now, if you or I would have chosen a paragraph to study as the centerpiece of the Seder night, I don't know about you, but this is not the paragraph I would have chosen, right? I would have chosen a paragraph from the book of Exodus, from the book of Shmo, talking about the Exodus. Why am I talking, what holiday do I bring the Bikurim on? Shavuot. Why am I including in the Haggadah a paragraph that is performed on the holiday of Shavuot, hundreds of years after the Exodus, by a farmer bringing his first fruits to the temple? Why is that the paragraph I'm learning? Well, close. Think of how he, you're on the track. Think of what the farmer says. And others have other answers, but I believe this is the compelling answer to me. The farmer begins as follows. Arami Oved Avi. My father was a wandering, or my father was threatened by an Aramean. Vayered Mitzrayim. And he went down to Egypt. Vayogar Sham. And he lived there. Vayoreu Osanu HaMitzrim. And the Egyptians tormented us. What just happened? Not just plural, first person. Right? What does the farmer do? He starts talking about something that happened to someone else, and in the middle, when you start to get to the birth of the Jewish nation, he says, what? This happened to me. That is historical participation. That is the second, or personalization. That's the second step. The first step is to be aware of history. The second step is to say, whatever happens to any Jew across time happens to me, and whatever happens to me happens to all Jews. And the paragraph that most clearly underscores that is the paragraph of Arami Oved Avi. It's the only paragraph in the Torah where someone living hundreds of years after an event, culmination, after an event is turning around and saying, guess what? That happened to me. And not only is the text speak to us of participation, but the very fact of the Torah study does as well. There is no act that we can perform that more clearly injects us into the historical flow than the act of Limud Torah. A friend of mine, who was a Baal Tshuva, started learning Gemara for the first time. He came to me and he said, Shmuel, he said, you know what I found astounding? Is that when I look at a page of Gemara, time falls away. Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael are talking in the time of the Mishnah, and then all of a sudden Rav Papa, who's hundreds of years later, starts arguing with him. And then Rashi starts chiming in from France centuries later, and then Rashi's grandchildren, the Tosafists, start yelling at their grandfather. And then I'm in the middle of this conversation. So what we're doing, both through act and through text, in that second stage, is we're moving from awareness to personalization and participation. And then what's the third stage of Magid? Third stage of Magid is Rabbi Gamliel Hoya Omer. Anybody who didn't say these three things has not fulfilled his obligation. What are the three things? Pesach, Matz, and Maror. Now, that's a very strange statement. Rabbi Gamliel is saying that in order to properly fulfill Magid, I have to say Pesach, Matz, and Maror. I have to talk about them. Wait, I'm turning the tools into the crux. I'm taking the story, right? Pesach, Matz, and Maror are tools to help me tell the story. They're not the story. So I believe what Rabban Gamliel is saying is I'm moving you to the third stage. And the third stage is historical perpetuation. How do you perpetuate history? How do you perpetuate your people? And the answer is you do it through physical, concrete, rituals and symbols.
I put on tefillin.
Thank God my son put on tefillin. Thank God my grandson will put on tefillin. Right? What? Exactly. And it means something different to each one of us because we're living in different worlds and we're different people. But guess what? It's the same tefillin. That's what Rabban Gamliel is saying. The passing of the torch is you pass down things that keep us together. And therefore, Rabban Gamliel is saying it's great to be aware of history and it's great to participate, but unless you make sure there are people to do the same tomorrow, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. And suddenly you back up and you look at Magid and say, wow, no, look at how the rabbis took me on a three-stage journey. And look at how they took me on this three-stage journey to make me feel, to inject me into the flow of history. So Magid, the mitzvah, helps us perform that third level of the Seder, which is that experiential level. One last thing I want to do, and we're running out of time, is turn to the last page. And here I want to give you a dugma. A dugma means an example. I believe, as I said to you, that every piece of the Seder fits into its location. It's connected to what comes before and to what comes after in very clear ways. I'm going to take an example and show you. This is something that was added later in the Seder. It's not a part of that original ancient text. It's one of the most beautiful moments at the Seder. We open up the door. We look out. Each one of us hopes maybe today he's really standing there looking at us, right? Elio Anavi. We sing the song, sweet moment, the moment all children remember, and then all of a sudden, the warmth of the moment collides with the text of the moment. What do we say? Shochamas ha'elagoyim, pour out your wrath on the nations, dot, 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 dot. And this is not only incongruous for the moment, it's incongruous in the Seder. Until now, we've spoken about ourselves. We haven't cursed the Egyptians. We've been talking about what they did to us, but we didn't. Even when and when we drank, when we said the 10 plagues, so we took out some of the wine, according to some, it's because we want to feel the sensibilities and sensitivities. So why am I doing this now? What is this Shvoch HaMoscho? Why is it here? So think about where it is in the Seder. It is at the moment when we're turning from the past and present to the future. And before we turn to the future, we turn to God and say, we can't turn to the future without reckoning with the past. We can't have good without eradicating evil. And we are therefore in this particular moment saying Shvoch HaMoscho. And if you want something to talk about with your kids at the Seder, think about this. Think about this moment. Recognize that on Purim, before Purim, we spoke about Amalek. And what did we say? We said, Zechor, remember what Amalek did to you. Don't forget, dot, 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 until you reach a goal. And what's that goal? You eradicate the memory of Amalek. So wait a minute. Is the goal to remember or to forget? It looks like I'm remembering in order to forget. The answer is no. There's a fundamental difference between forgetting and eradicating, between shchicha and mechia. When you forget something, it's still there. You just aren't paying attention. When you eradicate something, you've taken care of it. For a couple of decades after the Shoah, it was unfashionable to be anti-Semitic. It was unfashionable. It was like a bubble. Towards the end of that period, we started hearing things from the world. What did we hear? Why are you focusing so much on the Holocaust? Forget it. Move on. Things have changed. Things are better. And what's our answer? Look at the world today. Right? The moment you forget is the moment you are failing in the eradication. And that's what this moment is about. And I think that this is a moment that is particularly important for us to be discussing with our children, because we are still living in a time of testimony. Thank God there still are survivors of the Shoah to tell us, to testify. 30 years from now, if the Mashiach doesn't come, we'll be living in a time of memory alone, of remembrance. We won't have testimony. And if the world is doing this in a time of testimony, then what will it do in a time
when it's only remembrance, and how important it is at this particular moment of the Seder to maybe speak to our children about the importance of remembering things and maintaining that memory. And that's why this is here. You can't move to the future without reckoning with the past.
It's so important for us to recognize that, to feel it, and to remember it. And that's our, and it's our obligation to have it. Remember one thing, and with this I'll end. When Rivka is told that she's about to give birth to Yaakov and Esau, she is told, Ula'om mil om yamatz. She's told, one will always be stronger than the other. And the rabbis say, from here we learn, that if someone tells you that Caesarea and Yerushalayim are both standing, don't believe them. If someone tells you, God forbid, that Jerusalem is destroyed and Caesarea is also destroyed, don't believe them. But if someone tells you one is up and one is down, that you can believe. Jerusalem and Caesarea cannot coexist, or what the rabbis are saying. You can't have good without the eradication of evil. And that is what this moment is saying at the Seder. And is it an example of how all the pieces fit in so beautifully. All right, I hope that our shared thoughts will make all of our personal Siddurim more beautiful. Thank you so much for learning with me, and have a wonderful Chag Kosher V'Sameach. I want to announce that this was in memory this learning was in memory of someone we spoke about, of Zeb Tzvi Ben Zecharia. And I also brought a couple of hadgados for those people who still would like to.